Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and this is another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by the good people at Hotel Lincoln. The next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago, and you're looking for a cool boutique hotel that's close to everything, right around the corner from Lincoln Park Zoo, it's walking distance to the Second City. It's not only improviser-friendly, it's pet-friendly as well. Of course, we're talking about the official hotel of Improv Nerd, the Hotel Lincoln. Our guest today is Jill Bernard. She's an amazing teacher. She's an amazing improviser. She has dedicated her life to improvisation. She's not only passionate about it, she is so positive about it. And in this interview, we talked about her starting the Huge Theater in Minneapolis, where this episode was recorded. We talked about her learning Spanish so she could teach improvisation in Spanish. And we talked about something that I have struggled with, not only in improvisation, but in my life. And if you've listened to me on this podcast, I describe myself as an Eeyore, a person that cannot tap into joy and is always looking at the negative side of life. And Jill is probably one of the most positive people I know. And she's got this great energy about her. And for me, when I see people that are that positive and that joyful, I am skeptical. And so we talked about in this interview about how she taps into joy on stage. And she keeps it very, very simple. And without giving anything away, basically she doesn't take herself too seriously. And she goes into a classroom when she teaches and she imagines that she is a jar of olives. Now, she'll go in more detail about that because I can't do it justice. And I really appreciate that because I take myself way too seriously. I've always taken myself way too seriously. I do it in my teaching. I do it in my performing. I do it in when I'm writing my blog or doing this podcast. And it was really refreshing to hear it from her. And, you know, when I interview somebody who's got such great energy and so positive, I'm always looking to, you know, show me the dark side, show me the dark side. And certainly she talks about, she does have, you know, a dark side, as we all have dark sides. But I wish that I could have be more positive like Jill Bernard, because I think it not only would help me as an improviser and as a podcaster, but I think it would help me in my life. So here it is. I think you're going to get a lot out of it because I did. Here it is, the Jill Bernard episode. And this was recorded last summer up in Minneapolis at the Huge Theater. So enjoy.
He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah.
Now, you grew up, I'm getting right to the question.
Yeah, do it.
Okay, great.
Do it.
How are you feeling about this?
This is great. This is exciting. Great. We're all so super glad you're here and honored that you're here.
Now, have you heard the podcast?
I have heard the podcast.
Okay, because it's a world tour. Last week it was Denver, this week it's Minnesota. I'm so glad.
Wow.
Yes. All right. Are you embarrassed? Is this hard to be interviewed, or are you...
No, okay. No, it's not hard.
Okay, because you squinted your eyes and you're like, oh.
I'm just thinking of Denver to Minneapolis as a world tour. It was interesting to me.
I have a hard time with change, and I have a hard time traveling. So for me, it is a world tour.
Well, then we're even gladder that you're here.
Yes.
That's impressive.
All right, so you grew up in Evanston and Downers Grove, Illinois, and you said you'd get report cards that would say, Jill is silly. Tell us what kind of stuff you did as a kid that was really silly.
I just giggled. I just giggled constantly. Like, my mom still talks about when they test you to see if you can go into kindergarten, I fell off the balance beam and just giggled. It was hilarious to me that I couldn't pass their simple physical coordination test. And that's pretty much how... we lived in Evanston until I was, I think, 11. And the whole time was just...
Evanston is a suburb of Chicago.
It is. My father was going to Northwestern University, which is there. So we grew up. It's a lovely suburb. It's really easy to get in and out of the city. We had a great time there.
And then you said your mom, when you guys were growing up, you guys would make up songs. And you would also... she'd play piano and accordion. And you'd also make up stories. How has that helped you when you look back? Because you were improvising before you even knew what the word was.
Right, right. People have asked me, like, how do you make up stories? And to me, how do you not make up stories? I've always made up stories. Every night I've made up stories. And my mom really encouraged creativity. She did, like, I'm sure I was annoying as hell, just wandering around the house singing all the time, and she didn't ever stifle any of that.
But your dad, on the other hand, was a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And I would imagine there'd be a little stifling going on with him.
Yeah, my dad's a scientist.
Uh-huh.
And so he expects things to come out a certain way, which is often really disappointing when you're dealing with small children.
What was your relationship with your father?
My dad has these wonderful... he's very different now, which is funny. Everyone who meets my dad now...
likes him?
Loves him.
Right.
He's like this Walt Whitman-looking kind of Santa Claus, half-deaf, hobo, train chaser. He's delightful now.
But when you say he's a hobo tracer, there was something like he's pulling a...
Yeah, he lives in a van.
Okay. And this isn't a joke.
No, this is not a joke. Although he's off the road now because this morning he ran over his own foot with his van.
So he's in a van and is he pulling a trailer or something?
Yeah, he actually lives in a trailer. The trailer is a beautiful small apartment.
So if he's listening to the podcast, he lives in a trailer, not in a van.
Yes.
Okay.
The tools live in the van.
And what does he do? He drives around in the van?
He goes to different railroad museums and volunteers at them, restoring old train cars to their former beauty. And I think one of the coolest things about it is he's had the opportunity to be reunited. He's always been a train photographer since the early 60s. And he's had a chance to be reunited with trains that he took photographs of in 1964. Here's this same train car today in a museum in the middle of the desert in California.
And so today, if we met him, we would think he's this really kind Walt Whitman guy, right?
Yes.
But what was he like when you were growing up?
He yelled a lot.
Yeah, about what?
About everything.
Give me an example.
He had very specific ways that he expected meals to be prepared, and we would do our best, but there was always something that you would do wrong. He was a pretty angry guy in my youth. I think he was dissatisfied with his professional career and had a lot of frustration. That was hard for him.
And then you're 7 years old and you go see a play.
Yeah, we went to an outdoor production of Oklahoma.
And what changed after you saw that?
I was like, yeah, I could do that.
When you said you could do that, what could you do?
They were doing everything that I already did. They were singing and dancing and making believe. And I thought, well, if that's a job, I'll do that. And I never thought of any career since. Before that, I was going to be a pony. But,
so then you see the play, you then get into theater, and you go to college, you go to the University of Minnesota, where you major in theater.
Yes.
And then you're junior in college, and a friend suggests you audition for Comedy Sports here in Minnesota. What was that, when you saw improv, Comedy Sports, what attracted you to that?
I actually only saw one show before I auditioned, and it was terrible. Mm-hmm. It was still the worst Comedy Sports show I've ever seen. And it gave me this kind of false confidence, and I had a really great audition.
Like you could do it?
Yeah.
Like it was so bad,
it still
anybody
looked
could
fun.
Do it.
It looked fun, but yeah, the idea that I could do this, and the people were really nice. I was like, I'll do this, and fortunately, it turned out to be a much better show than what I thought it was, because now I've been there 19 years.
So you're still associated with Comedy Sports?
Yes.
And what is the thing about Comedy Sports? You know, as I was preparing the questions, my wife helps me with the questions, and we've had a lot of people who have done Comedy Sports on the podcast. And she pointed out something interesting. She said, people that do Comedy Sports have such joy to improvising. Where do you think, that's true?
Yes.
And what is it about their teaching or their style of play that brings out the joy in someone?
Have you met Dick Chudnow?
Tell us who Dick Chudnow is.
He's the founder of Comedy Sports. He lives in Milwaukee.
And that's where it originated, right?
Yes. And he is just a fountain of joy. He is pure joy. And he's just kooky and fun and goofy, and it's always about having the most fun. And he gave us all permission. He said, to those of you that are feeling insecure about whether you're good enough to be in comedy sports, you have suffered enough. Go ahead, enjoy yourself, have fun. You're supposed to be here. And he gave us that permission. And the show is so fun. The show, Comedy Sports, it's not a show, it's a match. Sorry, Dick.
What do you mean, sorry, Dick?
We play it as a sport. And Dick loves all of it that makes it a sport, like the fact that we're on a field instead of a stage, and they're fans instead of an audience. And yet we have matches instead of shows. And everything about the match is so much fun first, before anything else.
And what makes the match so much fun?
The audience is happy to be there. We're happy to be there. The games are fun to play. You're just set up. You're set up to have fun. You know about Freud's joking envelope? Freud had this theory of, we know when something's a joke. Like when you hear a priest and nun and a priest and a nun walk into a bar, we know that's a joke because it's surrounded by a joking envelope. Freud's joking envelope around comedy sports is so perfect. You know from the start that you're going to have a great time, and so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So how do you go from comedy sports, how do you get exposed to long form?
One of my colleagues at Comedy Sports at the time in the mid-90s was a woman named Shannon Lang, and she was in a group called The Impossibles that was doing mid-form.
What was mid-form?
Like a sloppy jam.
Okay.
And that was kind of down the rabbit hole to long form. I was also on message boards. This was when the internet was booming at first, and yesand.com was very popular, and you could talk to improvisers from around the country and hear different things. And through the Chicago Improv Festival, I got to see other stuff. And then we brought Mark Sutton and Joe Bill up here.
From Bass Prop.
From
Bass Prop. The Annoyance
Theater. And that, I think, was 2002. And that was my first real introduction. And then I've just studied as much as I could and toured and worked with as many people as I could. And that was kind of how I found it.
And you travel festivals. You go and you teach and you perform at festivals. I have to ask you, is there any festivals that you won't do?
No.
Okay, you'll do all the festivals.
I won't do unpaying festivals.
Okay. What is your perspective on improv in the whole country? Because you've gone every corner of this country and other countries too, but of this country, what do you see as a whole, improv?
It's growing all the time, and what's true, and what I've always hoped is true, is that great improv is happening in off-the-map sort of places. Great improv could happen anywhere, and it is. It doesn't have to happen in one of the big cities. It can happen in a place like Charleston, South Carolina, or Denver, right? There's all kinds of exciting things happening, and each of it has the flavor of the city that it is. Nobody's improv is identical. Like when you watch people from Seattle improvise, you can see the history of Seattle improv in them.
Now, one of your goals, you say, is to make Minneapolis known as an improv town.
Yes.
Now, here's how I look at this. You're up against Chicago, New York, and L.A. They have a lot of history, right? They're established improv communities. What do you think that Minneapolis needs to do to put itself on the map for improv?
Well, our improv history actually predates Chicago's.
Okay.
Dudley Riggs was founded 2 years before Second City.
You're talking about Brave New Workshop.
Yeah, the Brave New Workshop has been here a long time, so we do have a history. I don't need it to be an improv city.
On a national level?
On a national level. I want it to be, well, I think it already is. The Improv Festival here has gotten a great reputation and performers who've been here from around the country completely talk it up to their friends, and their friends come the next year, and people come back year after year to our improv festival. So I know we do have a really good national reputation. I don't ever see us needing to be bigger than New York or Chicago or LA. I like that we're a decent size without having so many improvisers that nobody gets any breathing room.
And what do you do? This is the second year of Huge. Mm-hmm. What do you need to keep doing to foster the community to get bigger and also deeper?
Well, when I say that I want us to be an improv hub, I want it to be the kind of a place where a person doesn't have to leave to have a full, rich improv.
Is that realistic? Is that realistic? Because a lot of people, I've gone to the smaller markets, and a lot of people, their desire is to go to New York, LA, and Chicago. How do you keep them here?
And that will never end. There will always be some kind of a talent drain to other places. You keep them here by giving them continuous opportunities, chances to create their own shows, chances to teach their own style. And that's why we built Huge, just to have a home for these things to happen, and to encourage people to kind of incubate their work here and let it spread. And give them a chance to create things.
Also, you're a teacher. Mm-hmm. And you said something very interesting, that you teach two things. You Are Enough and Play Joyful. Now, I say to my class a lot of times, you're enough. But I'll be honest with you, I don't know how to teach it per se. And I certainly don't know how to teach Play Joyful. How would you teach someone You Are Enough? First of all, is it you just say it over and over again? Because that's what I do.
I call them at 3 a.m.
Right.
Anybody could be a great improviser given time and will. So when you look at an improviser, even if they're not great now, you should be able to see the great improviser that is there. And so when I look at an improviser, I can praise that improviser, even if we're not at that place yet, even if there's a lot of obstacles between them and the best possible improviser they can be. We can see the light inside, the glow of the great improviser they will be. And I can give you scenic notes about the good stuff that you're doing, no matter what level we're at right now. I try to catch it as it. You can only catch it as it's happening. You can only point out to somebody that the move they just made, or the character choice they just made, was really good and wonderful. And you can occasionally start students over when they. You'll see them shop past their own ideas. They'll say something in an improv scene and then immediately discard it. If you could stop them in that moment and say, what you just did was wonderful and beautiful. Let's not skate past it. Let's not shop past it. That, what you just did, is beautiful. Let's stay there.
How do you have that point of view? Is it a life thing? Is it a spiritual thing? Is it something you developed, like a reaction to your dad always being angry? How have you developed that?
It's a combination of things, obviously, like everybody's life philosophy, a lot of trial and error, a lot of growing older. I believe very much in the Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz, who says, always do your best, because if you're doing your best, then you can't be mad about having failed, because you were doing your best. So anybody doing their best to the top of their integrity is going to be good.
Do you ever get down? Because I don't see you ever getting down.
Do you want me to call you at 3 a.m.? Is this a scam?
If you called me at 3 a.m., what would you be down about? What would you be down about? Because you're always up. You always have. You're always looking at the positive side. I'm Eeyore, on the other hand.
My boyfriend makes fun of me because I mostly yell at inanimate objects.
So there is some anger down there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, of course. Well, I'm this wonderful, wonderful hybrid of my parents. Like, at the time of my birth, like, my father is this creature of pure rage, and my mother is this creature of pure love. So when you get these things together, like, I sometimes feel these emotions that I know are older than I am. I'm also Irish bohemian. So I'm almost 100% guaranteed to be an alcoholic, right? Like an Irish bohemian inheritance.
Were either one of your parents alcoholics?
My father is an alcoholic. He's in recovery. He's in recovery, which is another reason he's nicer now. It's just... all you can do is take a look at the rage, know that it's older than you and that you don't want it, and convert it into something else.
Did you know your dad was an alcoholic before he got into recovery?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's kind of obvious. I suppose there are sneaky drunks.
When you say it was obvious, how was it obvious? Besides him being angry at the dinner table.
Oh, all the classic signs.
Like?
Textbook. He was a textbook alcoholic. I don't even remember the textbook now. But I remember being in health class and learning all the traits of an alcoholic and being like, yep, check, check, check.
Which I think a lot of us who go into improv, we come from dysfunctional families.
Yes. This is often true. It's not always true, but it's often true that there's some dysfunction. And I want to know if this is universal, because I haven't asked enough people about it yet. Mm-hmm. But the experience of when you begin improv or theater in general, like, I mean, I came from a scripted theater background. I think when you're young, you need the applause and acclaim from the audience to fill some sort of a hole that is in you left over. So the misery of your childhood can only be filled by the acclaim of 100, 200 people clapping for you and laughing at you. And then I feel like as you mature as a performer, what at least happened for me is at some point I caught up. And now I can improvise just for the art form and just because I love creating beautiful worlds.
What were you like back then when you first started and you had a bad show?
Yes. What was I like when I had a bad show?
Yeah, because if you want the approval, and I still struggle with approval, you know. If I have a bad show, I want to kill myself. And I'm not exaggerating, though my wife would disagree. What were you like when you had a bad show, and how has that changed?
I think I was very blamey, and it was someone else's fault.
On your team or the audience?
It would be like the audience, or I'm trying to remember.
What do you like now?
I don't think there are bad shows.
What do you mean by that? Because to me, when I hear that, I'm like, that's not realistic.
Everything I do is exactly what I meant to be doing in that moment, so how could it be bad?
Even if you're not getting the response from the audience.
I'm trying to think. I want to be honest in this moment. I think when we have a bad show, it's not the only show that we're going to do, so really it's just a small blip on a geological scale. And it doesn't really bother me. To me, it's just as funny to have a bad show as to have a good show. Sure, there's not the elation, but there's a different kind of feeling. I don't really mind failure so much anymore.
What's the benefit for you with failure?
It adds texture to life. You can't have highs without lows. I am a person who needs to be humbled. So anything humbling that happens makes me laugh hysterically. I took a tap dance class a few years ago when I was feeling very arrogant, and it was great.
Arrogant meaning you thought you had
meaning
it.
Like I had this shit on lockdown.
You had figured out. Improv. And
I am hot shit. Uh-huh. And I'm the only person I've ever met who, wearing tap shoes, cannot make a sound. Nothing happens, and I just laughed and laughed. And the teacher was like, "You're trying really hard." I was like, "I know, this is hilarious." And I didn't find it. I found it humanizing. I enjoyed the humanizing element of it. I like doing things that are too hard for me. I recently did a show in Spanish, and I'm at beginner level 4 at the time I did the show, and it was hilarious in how inept it was. Like members of the audience were feeding me verbs. and I it didn't bother me.
Why are you learning Spanish?
For so many reasons, but one of the main ones is I have nothing on my bucket list. I've done everything I want to do in life except learn Spanish. So really, you should get on that. Yeah, just the one bucket list item.
Oh, well, how many things were on your bucket list? Like four?
I don't know. I didn't have a formal bucket list. My mom's bucket list was to go to the Galapagos Islands. And on the plane ride back, she turned to me and she was like, well, now what do I do? and then that got me thinking about my own bucket list. Is there anything I would be miserable if I didn't accomplish by the end of my life? And the only thing is I would love to learn Spanish. So I started.
The joyful. This is totally for me, because this is something that I need to work on. And this is why I do this podcast, really. I realize why I'm doing this podcast.
You're an explorer now.
Well, I'm an explorer, but I want to get better, you know? And to admit something, you know, like something I don't want to admit after teaching 20 years or whatever, I want to bring more joy into the classroom. I don't know how to do it. You know, I'm in therapy. My therapist says, go in, you know, you're teaching something that's supposed to be fun. How does Jill go in there and bring joy into it?
Do you honestly want to know?
I honestly want to know.
I pretend I'm a jar of olives.
Okay.
Who would hire a jar of olives to teach an improv class? They flew me all the way to Toronto to teach this improv class, and I'm just a jar of olives. What a terrible mistake.
Now, how does that free you up to bring... I've got to break this down. Either I'm breaking the joy down, or I'm ruining the joy. And that's another thing I can do. Tell me about being a jar of olives.
By the way, I've never told this to a human being, I don't think.
Tell me how it worked, please.
I pretend I'm a jar of olives.
Like you go in and like, I'm a jar...
No, I pretend.
Or in your head you're just going, I'm a jar,
I'm a jar of olives.
That's your mantra in your head?
It's so naughty.
Naughty.
What kind of a... There's all... These 18 students have probably paid $80 to spend 3 hours with a jar of olives.
More than that, or is it that simple?
Have you read Overcoming Addictions by Deepak Chopra?
No, I haven't.
He has a story in the beginning about a patient of his who was addicted to heroin, and he tried to get her to remember, because the reason people are addicted to things is because they need a rush. A way of experiencing the world that's rich and full and not boring the way the actual tangible world is. And to get that rush, people turn to drugs or alcohol or sex or something.
Or food or gambling.
And he talked to this young woman and said, what was it that gave you that rush before any of this and before life stamped it out of you? And she said horseback riding. When she was very young, she'd been horseback riding. So he took her horseback riding, and she felt free, and she laughed, and she had a lovely afternoon like she hadn't had since small childhood. And if you can remember what it was that made you feel joy before everything came crashing down, that's a small step. I've taken up running as well, because there's a moment when you're running when it reminds you of small childhood and you feel like you could run forever. And for me, at my level of running, it only lasts a second.
You're doing like two blocks?
Yeah, well, okay. I ran a 5K.
Okay.
And Trish Barong is forcing me from Kansas City Improv Festival is forcing me to run another 5K. She's forcing me.
Gone help. Or how is she doing
help.
This?
No, she's asked me. We're going to run one.
Okay.
But there's a moment while running that feels like I could run forever, and it's just a second, and it's so great and so free. That's really the way to find joy, to find that thing that made you happy before people told you, put that down, get your fingers out of that, whatever it is.
And how important is finding that life balance to improv. Because I know, like, when I started out, you can make your whole life improv. And you have nothing to draw, you know, when you go on stage to improvise because you don't have a life. How is it, how do you find that balance? Because you're running a theater now. You're going, you're traveling, you know, all over the country and out of the country to teach.
It's something I added back in. I think I was the same way. I was nothing but improv for years and years. It's part of it is taking Spanish lessons to have something else to experience. I do have a boyfriend now, but I do other things.
You're smiling about that. Was that like a hard thing to get for you?
A boyfriend?
Yes.
I just didn't feel like I needed one.
Why?
I mean, if all you're doing is improv, I thought of myself for a while as an improv monk in a way, like just dedicated to the art form and not particularly hindered by anything else.
And how was having a relationship? Because I know, for me, I was the same way. I didn't really start dating until, and I'm not kidding, probably till I was in my 40s.
Yeah.
How has it changed your improvising and your teaching?
Eric has some.
Eric is your boyfriend.
Yes.
How long have you guys been together?
Three and some years.
Okay.
And he has just a really great effect in terms of helping me find balance, in terms of helping me think about things in a rational way. When I do feel like flying off the handle, he does point out the full picture, parts of the picture that I'm ignoring. Or skipping over.
So how does that help on stage?
How does that help on stage? It helps more off stage. It helps in that transition between on stage and off stage. Because when you go home by yourself and everything's still rolling around in your head, it can be nice to somehow balance that out with thinking about life as a whole.
Is he an improviser?
Yes.
Okay. And do you guys, when you get together, give notes, or do you say, oh, I had this bad show, and is there any boundaries that you set in terms of, because it could be talking always about improv.
Part of the beauty of our relationship is Eric talks a lot. He loves talking. So I don't really have to say anything. It's been great.
Okay, so when he's talking, do you tune him out sometimes?
Yes, it's harder now. We had a long distance relationship, and now he can
Where was
tell.
He living?
He's from Austin, Texas.
Okay. And now he lives in the Twin Cities?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So when did he just move?
April.
Okay.
Of this year.
So you guys are living together?
Yeah.
Okay. How was that adjustment?
It's funny because we're both 41.
Mm-hmm.
And when you live alone for a long time, you're like an elderly cat. And
right.
You have just the way you like things. Don't touch me kind of a stuff. But it wasn't hard at all, really. It wasn't hard at all.
Did you do it all at once? Like, he came here and you just moved in? Or did, like, for me, I had to go really slow. So we both lived in Chicago, and it's like, okay, let's do 2 nights a week. Let's do 3 nights a week. I had slowly built up to it over about 6-8 months before we moved in together, and then eventually we got married.
We dated long distance for 3 years, and he would come up for, like, a week every month for 3 years. But I think I knew on our third date that I wanted to be with him always, so it didn't really, ever seem like a problem, just except for being used to being alone.
What about marriage? Does that scare you?
No, we'll get married sometime.
Okay.
Not particularly in a hurry, but yeah, sometime.
Okay. We're going to improvise now.
Yes.
We're
going
to take a suggestion. So what do you want to take a suggestion of? A location, just a word, a relationship? How do you like to start?
Are we going to sit in these chairs and improvise?
No, we're going to get
okay.
up.
Good.
Yeah. Why did you say that? Are we going to sit in these chairs?
Well, because that could influence the suggestion.
Okay.
You could say something like, where would two people be sitting in chairs?
Okay. Do you like to be active on stage?
Yeah.
Okay. So... what do you want to take a suggestion?
What's a word that is a verb and a noun?
True.
Truth.
Truth. True.
That's not
it's a noun. I it's said, a verb now.
I said Drew.
You said Drew. So you said your own name. Drew. Drew.
Okay, so when you hear Drew, how do you process a suggestion?
It depends what kind of show we're doing, but okay, I probably so we're just doing, think about drawing. I probably just draw something.
Okay, in the scene.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So let's...
Yes, I shut it.
I know, I just I haven't talked to you in a couple hours, and I just want to see everything was all right.
Ethan, nothing's all right. I need to show you something.
Okay.
Come to the easel.
Do you see it, Ethan?
Oh, Candace, oh my God. Oh my God.
That's why I shut my door. I didn't want you to see, but you're right. Honesty, open doors. Doors should be open.
Candace, you've been spending like months on this.
Months.
And you just took a marker and you just put a big X in it.
Yes.
Oh my God, Candace.
It's all been a mistake, Ethan.
I still love you.
How could you?
I still
love you. Ethan, don't be a fool!
Candace.
Oh, does he have a monster?
Candace, you're not a monster.
Monster!
Candace, you're not a monster. You can squint your eyes and make a monster face. I know what you're trying to do. I know what you're trying to do, Candace. It's not going to work, okay?
It's not going to work, Ethan?
We've been living together for a couple weeks, and now you're trying to break up with me.
You're so transparent.
Yes, it is. Last month. Do you remember this? I hate Ethan. And then you had a gun to my head.
God, I should have seen it then.
Candace.
That's such a good likeness of you, though.
It's a great likeness. You are a great, great artist. Okay? That's... you're so frustrating sometimes.
I know. I'm frustrated with myself. Don't you think I'd rather me leave me than you leave me? Or you leave me, my God.
Okay. Candace.
Ethan.
Yes. It's going to be fine. I'm not going anywhere. Okay?
You're not?
I'm not.
Really?
Really. I know you had a hard childhood. You had four fathers.
Four.
And they all left you.
All of them.
Okay? I'm not going to leave you. I'm here for you, Candace.
You're here?
I'm here. In this house. For you. Now, why am I talking like this? You're not 14 years old.
Aren't I, though? Aren't we all every age that we've ever been all the time?
I guess you're right, Candace. I guess you're right.
You're not going to leave.
I'm not going to leave. I made a commitment when I moved in with you. I love your cat.
He is a great cat.
He's a great cat. I love when he jumps up.
So good.
He's so good.
Such a good cat.
He's a good, good cat.
The way he jumps up.
Yeah.
Clings to you.
Yes.
Like some fuzzy cravat. But I do hate you, Ethan.
I know. I have a lot to be hated for.
Yes.
I yell at you for stupid things.
You claim to love my cat.
I claim to love your
cat. And yet lock it in a cupboard continually.
Because I want to sleep at night. If the cat comes in under the bed, he starts clawing. You don't.
It's adorable.
Oh my God, he's taking all the foam out of the bed, Candace.
And spread it about.
Every morning I have to get up and clean up the hairballs and all the foam. It gets a little annoying. No, I don't love the cat.
No.
But I'm doing it for you.
Locking a cat in a cupboard for me?
Yes. It's the way I show my love. My mom did that.
She locked you in that
yes,
cupboard?
Yes, she did.
And you still think of the cupboard as a womb-like space.
Yes. Yes, I do. I feel safe there. I feel like everything is okay when I'm in that cupboard.
Well, why don't you sleep in the cupboard and let the cat stay out?
Because I'm too big now.
Couldn't we build you a large cupboard?
We could. Let's do that.
Some sort of a chifferobe?
Yes. I'll build enough space so you can come in there with me sometime.
I don't like small spaces.
We can build a huge cupboard.
Then it's not a cupboard anymore.
I don't What if we called it a cupboard, but it was really a garage? Candace, come on.
I'm willing to spend several minutes in the cupboard garage with you.
Okay.
But then I'll probably have to step outside of it. Because as you know, my third father left me in a garage. A public garage, a municipal ramp. It was a cold night.
I remember.
I huddled by the gate for warmth, but gates aren't warm.
And gates can't help you find your father.
No.
No matter how long you talk to that gate.
It's just a gate.
Yes.
It's a recorded voice. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
Please take a ticket, isn't an insistent woman.
But you didn't know that.
No.
You were only 6 years old.
Six.
I'm sorry that happened.
I'm sorry you had to sleep in a cupboard. We've both had horrible
childhoods. Yes, we have. You're beautiful. You know that? I don't care how many times you put this charade on of wanting to leave. I still love you.
I love you. In the midst of hating you, I love you. I'm sorry I'm like this.
I don't care. This is what I like about you, the unpredictability. Some would say it's crazy. I say it's unpredictable. Whatever you do, Candace, don't try to take your life. That scared me.
I won't.
Tell me. Promise me. If you're going to do it again, come and talk to me before you do it.
I will. I see now that was a mistake. And thoughtless.
You're not alone.
No, I'm not alone. Have you? Have Winston?
You have your art. And you know what I'd like to see for you? I'd like to see you be a world-renowned artist, that it would be in museums, not just in this back room we have.
I'm too old.
No. Art has nothing to do with age.
Not the Grandma Moses speech.
Yes.
She's terrible.
It doesn't She's matter.
Terrible.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
I want to be a roadside freak!
Listen to me, Candace!
This is why!
No! Don't destroy what you've already created. This could be your Grandma Moses. I see that the comparison to Grandma Moses is very similar to what you did. Why do you have to get in your own way? What are you doing with that knife? Give me the knife, Candace. Give me the knife. Thank you. I don't know why I'm going to put it in this drawer, but I am.
Because it's a knife drawer.
You are a very talented artist, Candace. Very talented artist. You know who your worst enemy is? You. Every time you get enough paintings to have a showing, you know what happens? You take that freaking knife out and you slash them.
Because they're not good enough.
Candace, you don't understand. They are good enough. You have to put it out there. How can you call yourself an artist if you're not willing to display it?
Is that what art is? It's not art unless it's on display?
Yes. Then it's just a hobby. And that's what you're doing. It's just a hobby.
So all the masterpieces that the Nazis stole and hid aren't art while they're hidden?
Yeah.
They're only art when they're out?
Yes. And those things that the Nazis stole, they were on display before they stole them and hid them.
So once you're on display, you're art for always? Or you stop being art during...
Candace, please! This is what I'm talking about!
In a Velveteen Rabbit sort of situation where once you're real, you're always art?
Candace, for God's sakes! I'm going to take these six pictures. I'm going to take them with the slashes, and I'm going to go down to the coffee shop. I'm going to go to Dollop Coffee Shop.
No!
And I'm going to Dollop.
Not Dollop!
Yes! Candace, why not Dollop?
They have almond milk with
vanilla
in it!
Oh,
why is there vanilla? It's supposed to be almond!
I'm taking them, Candace. I'm taking them, and I'm letting the world know that you are an artist. That I... I'm an artist, too.
You are an artist.
Yes.
Just because no one will buy your book? Because your book is unpublished? Are you an artist? Do books follow the same rule as visual art? That they must be read to be art?
Yes. And that's why I made some copies. Xerox copies. And I'm going to drop them off at Dollop, and I'm going to leave them there. And somebody, all they have to do is read one sentence. All they have to read, and they see the title of The Tiger Must Die. Don't make fun of it.
I'm not. It's a very good story.
It's a story.
Very good story.
You know what it's about?
Yes.
What?
I've read it. You think I haven't read it?
Well, I don't know.
The Tiger Must Die? You think it was sitting in that pile while you were away at the market and I didn't
You read it?
Of course I've read it.
You read my book?
Of course I've read your book.
I had that thing. You're kidding me.
It was sitting right there by the knife drawer.
But I
It
just,
was in my way.
There was a Coke can on that. There was a Coke can and I thought you were just using
it. Yes, I read The Tiger Must Die.
Oh my God, what did you think?
Beautiful.
Oh my God! Yes! Yes!
It's so beautiful.
You don't know how much this means to me.
And so derivative of Life of Pi.
Oh my God! That's exactly what I was going for. I was going for Life of Pi. Oh God, I love you, Candace. Oh, mwah, mwah. I am an artist. You read it.
I did read it. It was very good.
Did you cry at the end? Just like in Life of... What did you cry more? Life of Pi or that?
I cried all through your book.
Oh my God. That's what I was going for. A sad tale about a kid and a tiger. Did you notice that the kid was kept in a little cupboard just like me?
Yes.
Oh my God, Candace. I love you. I love you. I love you.
I need to ask you something. Am I the tiger?
Improv. 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 Improv.
So, how did you feel about that?
It was fun. That's what everyone says. I liked it a lot. It's weird when you improvise with someone for the first time, because you don't have a natural built-in rhythm. I liked it. Your sweater's very soft.
Thank you. Do you think we found a rhythm?
Yes. I mean, we'll listen to it later on the podcast and see, but I felt like yes.
And some of the choices we made, what did you feel that you liked that were strong choices?
Is this why you don't have any joy?
Yes. Exactly right. So let me ask you this. Okay, so after a scene, what do you do?
After a scene, I wonder for a while what happened to them.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, what happened? Did he? What did he say? Was she the tiger? I think she was the tiger.
Yes, I do too.
Which is a horrible implication. Because tigers are so fierce and monstrous, but also very flattering.
So you don't, after a scene, you will not go and break the scene down, or you won't say, you know, I did this well, I didn't do this well. You don't do any of that.
It depends what our needs are.
Meaning what?
If the show we're doing is one, if we're in the middle of a run of a certain show, and there were points we were hoping to hit that we didn't hit, if there were things we needed to do to make the form strong and we didn't accomplish those things, then we can look at those. This is also why I go to the opera alone, because I want to stay in that world for a while. So I don't like these things to happen right after, in terms of being critical about the choices that I made. I mean, if we look back at the scene we just did, there were moments where I was probably jokier than I needed to be, but I'm never mad at myself I'm never too mad at myself, because that's a lifelong hilarious improv flaw that you mentioned when I took your class years ago. And so whenever it rears its head again, I laugh like an old friend. I spoke over you a bit, which is another old mistake that I work on improving. So I'm never too hard on myself. I just try to get better.
I liked it. I really, really enjoyed it, because I've never played with you before. I felt, you know, because I taught a workshop, I'm like, oh, I gotta react emotionally. So I felt I was pushing that probably too much, and I really, so I was a little self-conscious of that. Do you get self-conscious when you're in front of students that you teach?
Yes, particularly if what we're doing illustrates the topic I was just covering. Like if I teach solo improv and then I do a drum machine show that night, I get what Johnstone calls big hands. When you're too conscious of your moves, your hands are just too big. I get really conscious. But most of the time I'm able to laugh that off too.
Now, when you go back to look at this scene, will it happen at 3 a.m. this morning? Will you get up the next day and in the afternoon go, oh, you know, I'm thinking about that scene and I wish I would have done this, or I wish I would have done that? Or is it just gone?
I have a really terrible memory, so it's probably just going to be gone, but I'll think about it tonight and into the morning probably.
Okay. And what kind of stuff would come up?
I'm going to continue to wonder about those two people. I thought they were really interesting people.
I did too.
I'll continue to think about those people because they were so interesting.
There was a sadness to them.
Sad.
Yeah.
So sad. And it was interesting, all that we pulled from the interview to bring into it, to look at in a different light like that. That's mostly what I'll do in terms of evaluation, because it's not like we have to, it's not like you and I are working duo where we need to be really critical about our next show that's coming up.
So when you were like Joe Bill, you do stuff at festivals and stuff like that. Do you talk afterwards? Because that would be an ongoing working relationship.
We get off stage and we say, I love you too, I love you. We have so much fun together that we just spend some time gushing. And then if there was any kind of a hiccup in terms of the mechanics, we discussed that. Anything that was a bit of a hiccup, we talk about but mostly we just enjoy each other's company. And when Joe and I perform it, the lights always come down too soon, it feels like. And we're always heartbroken because we had so much more we wanted to spend time
with. I almost felt in our scene that it came out too soon.
Yeah, you know,
and that's
yeah. Yeah, what the hell? What the hell, kid?
Right.
Just kidding.
So people listening to this podcast, they're probably thinking, well, they go and they have a love fest and there's nothing wrong. But how does that make me better? How would you explain that to them?
How does that make you better?
To come off stage, you've done a show, maybe there's a couple hiccups, and you're going, oh, I love working with you. Oh, I love working. It's a love fest. How does that make you better? Because most improvisers want to go, and they, like me, they want to dissect it, say, this is what I did wrong. This is how what I can improve it. So how does that make you better? How for you?
I mean, the things that I noticed that were hiccups will always be really clear notes to myself on what I need to work on for next time. And I do work on them. I don't feel the need to analyze it second by second because those seconds are never going to happen again. But there will be themes and threads and moments that exemplify an interesting element or something ishy, Susan Messing would say. That we can look at. I mean, in the past, I've looked at shows minute by minute, and it didn't make the shows any better.
Did it make you better?
No, I don't think it did.
And that's why you stopped doing it.
Yes, I think it's more important to spend time thinking about what went well and how can we replicate that.
Great. We are going to take some questions from the audience. So if we could just turn the house lights up. And if you have a question for Jill or anything we just did on stage, let's now's the time to ask her a question.
Oh, have you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were we gonna say?
What were you gonna say?
I was gonna say maybe you've never done a Q&A in Minnesota before, but fortunately Bridget's here from Texas, so she'll ask. We imported her to ask the first question. At Q&A's in Minnesota, it's very hard to get the first question out.
Why is that? The politeness of Minnesotans?
Yes, we're very polite. We don't want to bother you by pestering you with the question. Even though you asked us to ask you a question.
Texas, she doesn't care. She's from Texas. So Bridget from Texas. Where in Texas are you from, Bridget?
I'm not from there. I'm living there, just to clarify. I'm living in Austin, Texas. I don't want to like do people a disservice by pretending to be from Texas.
Okay.
I don't sound like I'm from there.
So. Okay, your question?
My question is very small, but how did you come to decide to pretend to be a jar of olives? Like, how did you come up with that as a solution to feeling floofy when you teach things?
I think in images sometimes, and that's just the image that came to mind. And I know what shape of a jar of olives it is, too. It's one of those ones that's a little wider at the bottom and thinner at the top. And it has an old-fashioned label, probably shiny and red and yellow, but I've never been able to find that jar of olives in the store.
Thank you, Bridget. Yeah, we got a question back here.
This is for both of you. With the amount of experience that you each have, do you get nervous before performance, and how do you prepare before you go on stage?
I was nervous tonight.
I was too. Yes.
In the moments when you are very nervous, this is something Keith Johnstone taught me. Just all you can do in that moment is be efficient. It's too hard to put pressure on yourself that I have to go out and do the best show that I could possibly do. Jimmy Carain's here all the way from Chicago. That's over 400 miles. I better do a really great show. That's too much pressure. All I can do is be efficient and just do nice, clean, good work with the tools that I know I have. What do you do?
For me, I didn't do this tonight. But typically, if I get nervous, I will call somebody on my cell phone before and say, you know what, I'm really nervous, I'm really afraid. Or I'll come into a class and I'll say, I don't feel like I have it, I don't feel like I can offer them anything, I feel like a fraud. I will call somebody and verbalize that, and that usually helps.
Is there a phone tree that you go to?
Yeah, I've got like four or five people that I know that can help me.
That's nice.
You know, and the other thing is to find people that are in improv to do that, so they understand it, and they, especially if they know your reputation, they can say, you know, Jimmy, you're, you know, they're flying you all the way to Minnesota. You can't be that bad. You know, stuff like that. Honestly, I need that. I need that. Yes. And we had another question. Right here.
Did you believe yourselves to be lovers when you, when she was first behind the closed door, or did that come up later in the scene? So she was behind the closed door for a certain amount of time. That was set up for the start of the scene. Did you think you were lovers at that point when you walked through the door to try to help her out?
When I first came in, I thought there was kind of a vibe like we could have worked together. You know, as like we were office mates or something like that, or boss employee relationship, and then it seemed like to me it transformed into a romantic relationship. That was my discovery. How about for you?
I wouldn't have pegged it as lovers in that first moment. Because the suggestion was drawing, I thought I was an artist, and I thought of the relationship in that way, that brand of artist that acts loverly to everyone, who just kind of drapes themselves on everyone as if they're lovers, whether they are or not. So it had that kind of warmth to it.
And I think, too, when you started to throw yourself against the wall, again, if you're listening to the podcast, you couldn't see it, but Jill threw herself against the wall, and I thought, well, who would do that? I mean, they must be pretty intimate if she would do something like that. Another question. Right back here.
Yeah, Jill, I heard a rumor that you started performing improv before you knew what improv was. Is that true?
I started performing improv before I'd taken an improv class. And also, well, yeah, in my opinion, I thought I invented improv. Before I went to University of Minnesota, I went to Coe College in Cedar Rapids, and my classmate Jennifer and I, we were hosting a variety show.
And like sketch?
Yeah, it was
stuff?
Like there was dance, there was singing, there was sketch, and we were the hosts. And I said, you know what, Jennifer, let's not write a script for the in-between stuff. Let's just make something up. And then Viola Spolin flew through time, stole my idea, and took it back with her. I was like, let's just make it up. And we did characters just interacting in between the pieces in this variety show. And that was before I'd ever known what improv was.
Let's talk a little bit about solo improv for a second.
Sure.
It's becoming a really big thing these days. How do you approach solo improv versus what we just did, a two-person scene?
My own solo improv or solo improv in general?
Give me Drum Machine.
This is something that Joe Bozic from the Brave New Workshop gave me permission to do, because I'm a big ham, and I do interact with the audience. So in a solo piece, I'm allowed to do that. I'm allowed to break the fourth wall as often as I want to. And the other great thing about solo improv is you can do half offers because you know the other half. So you can say, hey, what's that? And not feel like you're being ungenerous to your scene partner, because you're going to fill it in a second. And because there's no one else improvising with you in solo improv, at least the way I do it, I just throw a lot of ideas in the air at the beginning and then tie them together on the way back down. That's the way Drum Machine is structured for me. I just throw a lot of stuff up in the air, and then knowing that on the way back down, I'll make things make sense.
Do you think that it's its own skill, solo improv? So someone could be really great on a Harold team or doing a duo, but solo, they might not be that good at.
This is an interesting question, because there's probably a solo form for everyone, but I haven't tested this theory yet. I've taught a bunch of solo improv, and no one has done a piece that was any worse than their group work. So it was at the level of their group work. I haven't met anyone I mean, there are solo forms that are the wrong form for an individual. Like Andy Ettinger teaches people a form he invented.
Andy, who teaches at Second City, and he did Sybil.
He teaches people how to do the Sybil, and that form doesn't look great on everyone. But I bet you we could talk to that individual to whom the Sybil is not a natural form and find a solo piece that's customized for them based in their upbringing, their aesthetic, their strengths and weaknesses that would be nice for them.
So what advice would you give someone who wants to do solo improv?
Figure out what it is that you love about improv. Figure out what it is about your aesthetic that you enjoy, because your solo piece might have elements from the rest of your life. If you love a particular kind of music, or if you love things that are abstract, these elements can be in your solo form. No one's saying that they're not. And also, everything that's your weakness in group work is your strength in solo work. Like the example we just gave of what a ham I am and the way I cheat out. That's a strength in my solo work, a deficit. So you can customize something for yourself and then find a way to test it in a small scale. If you can find 5 minutes at an open mic or in between some group work, because solo improv tells you what it wants to grow up to be. You do a small example of it, and it's really clear that, oh, what I need to do next time is add more characters or follow one storyline, or some note becomes clear.
You came up with Drum Machine because?
It combines absolutely everything that I love about improv. Characters, sweepingly epic historical storylines, music, romance. When we moved into my grandparents' house in Downers Grove, there were a lot of science fiction books like Isaac Asimov and Ray Bradbury, and I was also stealing my mother's romance novels. So those two kinds of stories together created the kind of stories I like to tell. So I threw all those things together to make Drum Machine.
And what inspired you to do it?
It was at the time about I took that tap class. It was about the time that I needed a new challenge. Improv was getting pretty easy for me, and I wasn't scared anymore. And if it's not scary at all, you should find something to make it more.
What would scare you now, today? What's your next? In improv.
Well, doing the show in Spanish, the solo show in Spanish, was the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my entire life. And now I think that to piggyback on that, to do a group show, or at least a duo in Spanish, I'm getting cotton mouth thinking about the idea, because it would be such a challenge.
Now, you said you had no desire to go to New York, LA, or Chicago.
Correct.
And it's pretty clear to me that your goal is for yourself to be a star in the improv community nationwide.
I don't know what stars are for.
Is that true, or is that just fake humility?
That's not the way I look at it. What I want to do, my goal is to travel around the world and the country, teaching and performing and meeting great people. And if to do that, you have to be a star, I would be a star. But if you could do that and labor in obscurity, that would be fine as well. I just need to be famous enough that I'm in demand enough to get to do what I really want to do, which is travel to different cities and meet fascinating people and work with fascinating students.
When you started in Minnesota here, do you have any aspirations to do Brave New Workshop? Because that's like the Second City or the Groundlings here in Minnesota.
Well, I'm not really well suited to sketch comedy.
Why?
Because I have a really poor memory. It's painful for me to memorize scripts. And when I worked with the Scrimshaw Brothers, we had a rule. They couldn't write me more than 18 lines because I just couldn't hold them in my head. And joining the Brave New Workshop was never really in my plan. As much as I love them and respect them.
I think we're done. Mm-hmm. Yes, do we have a question?
I have one. I was curious how you both got into teaching. And what drove you in that direction? What made you decide that, oh, this is something that I'd like to do?
I got into teaching because Audrey Crabtree moved to New York and they didn't have anyone else to teach at Comedy Sports. And it turned out that I really loved it.
For me, I had been around improv a long time, and I really loved it, and I'm like, you know what? The only way you can make money at improv is become a teacher. And so mine was financially, really, so I could stay around and hang around doing something that I loved.
And what year was that about?
Oh, my God. It was, I was 27, so I started at the Annoyance Theater. I was, that'd be 22 years ago.
Cool.
Yeah.
We're still doing questions. I have questions.
Yes. We're still doing questions.
What do you think the Minneapolis style improv is, if everyone has kind of their own field?
When people in other cities describe Minneapolis, they talk about how playful we are and how fantastical.
What do they mean by how fantastical?
Well, part of it is that Drum Machine and the Bearded Men are the two troops that go out the longest, the most, mm-hmm. As well as groups from the past, not the past, but Five Man Job used to spend a lot of time on the road. The Minneapolis spend a lot of time on the road. And those groups really highlight not necessarily realistic situations. They'll do grounded work in an unrealistic situation, like a pirate or... in my case, it's always some historical event, so it may be something beyond our normal appreciation of things. But people also talk about the joyfulness of it a lot as well.
Yeah. Did you have a question, Alex? Someone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. I was wondering, like, if any of you even have them now, but do you have, like, inclinations or crutches that you go to or that you find yourself doing a lot that you're like, maybe I should try breaking this because I always... do this because it's comfortable for me.
What are you talking about, Alex? I have no idea. What? Who's this guy? Where did he go from?
Is that one of your crutches?
I don't know.
What's the name of that character?
It depends what historical period. He's been Franco. He's been Santa Ana. He's been... gosh, there's been so many great historical men.
I think, like, for me, my biggest crutch is probably anger and frustration, because I can play that so easily. And sometimes I feel like, do you ever feel this? Like, the same scene is played in your head over and over again. Like, it's a relationship scene, and I get frustrated. Or so I would say that's certainly one of my crutches.
Yeah.
Any more questions? Yeah, back here.
Jill, you talked about how you don't feel bad about any choices that you made because everything that you did was what you intended to do at that moment. How it was received is not something that you're going to judge. Is that just a matter of letting go of your expectations of the audience and how you want them to react? You just put stuff out there because that's what you want to show? Like I think a lot of people get judgy if they don't get a big response from the audience, whether through humor or whatever. But I know you do a lot of serious work too. And is that just a matter of being okay with whatever comes? Or I'm just trying to make sure I understood what you were saying when you're talking about that.
They probably can't hear your question on the recording.
I think it's like getting comfortable with not getting the response, right?
Yeah.
Like you're okay. It's easy to say you're okay with, you know, with your choices, but if you're not getting the response, how do you react?
I don't have a set response that I was expecting. It's going to have the audience and my partner is going to respond the way that they're going to respond, and the universe will align after the fact. This is something else Deepak Chopra talks about. There is no right or wrong. You make a decision, and everything aligns after the fact. You might think you had the best, you just applied and got the best job in the world, but it turns out all your coworkers are assholes. Or you might think it's tragic that you missed your flight, but in the waiting area, you're sitting next to a woman who becomes the love of your life. All of these things that could be wrong decisions, it's only wrong if you have set in your mind how it's supposed to be. And certainly some shows have an outcome that you're hoping, like Comedy Sports, for example. It says comedy in the name, so you're hoping that the audience is going to laugh. But if they don't, that's just one of the other billion of reactions that they could, that an audience can have to something.
Any more questions?
Sorry,
yes.
Is this long form improv versus short form? Like this is this theater, or you guys are based like kind of long form?
Huge theater is dedicated exclusively to long form because there wasn't a theater like that in town.
And that's
our mission that we were founded was to be a place where you could see quality long form improv all week long instead of having to seek it out at the Brave New Workshop student shows or at the Bryant Lake Bowl in odd time slots.
Is it difficult sometimes if you're improvising with like a short form performer if you're used to long form or vice versa?
You know, it's really amazing what we discovered when we opened is that a lot of the strongest long-form performers in town are also short-form players. At least in Minneapolis, there's a lot of cross-training. Like, The Mess was the show that just went on between the 8 o'clock show and this recording now, and half of those people were brought up in short-form and half of them were brought up in long-form, and they're all fantastic. I think we're lucky in that regard.
Great. Any more questions? Oh my God, this has been wonderful. Jill, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Jill Bernard, thank you so much. And check out the Huge Theater. How do people, if they're in Minnesota, the Twin Cities, how do they get to the Huge Theater?
It's pretty much right at Lynn Lake. It's at 31st and Lindale. And we're also online at hugetheater.com is the easiest way.
Oh, my God. Thanks again. You've been a great guest. And if you want to know more information about...
So there you have it. It's another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. It's the Jill Bernard episode. And I want to thank Jill for not only being our guest, but being such a gracious host in getting me up there to the Twin Cities at Huge Theater and doing this Improv Nerd, but also hosting me for a series of Artist Low Comedy workshops. And I really appreciate that very much and all the good people at Huge Theater. I want to thank my producer, as always, Ben Caprero. He's the one. Without him, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. And as you know, I've said it many times before, but we are on feralaudio.com. Improv Nerds on feralaudio.com. I said it again. We aren't there alone. There's some other great podcasts, so check them out. People like Chelsea Peretti, Todd Barry, Matt Dwyer, Dan Harmon, Steve Agee. The list go on and on. So check out feralaudio.com. If you want to know more about me, Jimmy Corain, the host of Improv Nerd, and my award-winning classes, The Artist Low Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, which will give you tips on how to become a better improviser, go to jimmycorain.com. I want to thank our sponsor, Hotel Lincoln, and I want to thank you for listening. And remember, as always, walk, don't run.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. And he's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like,
yeah.
He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a
I don't know what you want from me.
And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My